This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 253 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing Chapter 38, entitled, For Those in Peril on the Sea.
So the title, For Those in Peril on the Sea. As soon as I read this, I sang it. I had a visual or aural flashback of Kate Winslet singing this line in a church in some Jane Austen movie. I swear it's every third Jane Austen novel made into a movie, which it can't be, as the song is from the mid-19th century. And of course, Jane Austen is from, I believe, the late 18th century, definitely in the 1700s. So that I was wrong there. But my association with Kate Winslet was correct. So
I'd like to have an association with Kate Winslet.
This is from an Anglican hymn. And as soon as I Googled it, I found out why I had an association with Kate Winslet. It was used in the movie Titanic.
Arguably my least favorite Kate Winslet movie.
A hymn traditionally associated with seafarers, particularly in the maritime armed services. Written in 1860, its author William Whiting was inspired by the dangers of the sea described in Psalm 107. It was popularized by the Royal Navy and the United States Navy in the late 19th century, and variations of it were soon adopted by many branches of the armed services in the United Kingdom and the United States. Services who have adapted the hymn include the Royal Marines, Royal Air Force, the British Army, the United States Coast Guard, and the United States Marine Corps, as well as many navies of the British Commonwealth. Accordingly, it is known by many names, variously referred to as the Hymn of Her Majesty's Armed Forces, the Royal Navy Hymn, the United States Navy Hymn, or just the Navy Hymn, and sometimes by the last line of the first verse, For Those in Peril by the Sea. I'll share the link in the show notes.
So is that the song that they sang in the little church service on the Titanic?
Yes. I mean, they may have shown like little bits of the song, but literally like the end of the chorus, I think, is that. Do you remember the tune?
Of course not.
Do I remember it?
Of course you do.
Of course I do. It's very short. For those in peril on the sea. That's it.
That's like the end, like melodically the end of every hymn ever written. So even if you're wrong, you're right.
I know, right? Eileen P. also has a comment about this title. She goes, here's the first verse. She also identified it correctly. Not that it's hard, but she identified it. And here's the first verse. Eternal Father strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave, who bidst the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep. Oh, hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea. And she also shares a link to all the verses and more information about the hymn on the U.S. Navy website. And there's also a link that she shares with us to a video of the U.S. Navy band Sea Chanters singing the first verse.
Sea Chanters singing a sea shanty? Shanty Chanters?
So, now that we've covered the title, we can go forward with, like, and on with the show. We last visited Roger aboard the Gloriana as he left Scotland and got used to the work schedule while at sea. Thinking about Bree, he was, and chapter 38, this one, opens again on the Gloriana. Bad weather keeps passengers below decks for about 3 days. Holy monkeys, I wonder if 3 days here has any symbolism. Going into the dark, coming up, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. We could talk about that again at the end. How lovely it must have been below. Quote, green gilled as mushrooms, bruised from being pitched to and fro in the hold like billiard balls, reeking of renewed seasickness and overflowing chamber pots. Unquote. Yum.
Delicious.
Did you say delicious?
Exactly.
Oh, gross. A little girl, however, happy to be free from the hold, was dancing and singing around him. He doesn't say, or I should say the text doesn't say, whether the little girl was singing in Gaelic or not, but whether their conversation they had about that song, about that the content of that song was in Gaelic or not. But it really doesn't matter. The text is a basic translation. The text that Diana gives us is a basic translation of a song about a large sea monster in Scottish Gaelic folklore called, and I hope I don't butcher it too badly, there are three names given it. Kieran, Kieran Krohn, or Conarin Cro. So we'll include a link to this as well, and you guys can, we'll have to ask Agav next time he's on. So there's an old saying that claims that this monster was so large that it fed on seven whales. Local folklore held that this huge animal can disguise itself as a small silverfish when fishermen come in contact with it. Other accounts state the reason for the disguise was to attract its next meal. When the fishermen would catch it in its small silver fish form, once aboard, it changed back to the monster and ate him. Eileen P. writes, "It's no wonder mythical beasts are blamed for storms at sea during the 18th century. What else could make the waves so big? Roger's wee friend, Ishabel, chants a popular Caithness rhyme. And according to Encyclopedia Mythica, Kieran Croen translates to gray crest. Quote, a fabulous sea monster in Scottish Gaelic tradition. Reputed."
Wow. What did you have for dinner? Was it liquid?
That was rando.
Is that a liquid dinner?
Summer. No, it was salad with a little
like
bit
a
of
champagne vinaigrette was, straight out of the bottle.
No. It was Dijon champagne, mustard,
Prosecco,
olive oil, and balsamic vinegar.
Most vinegars start from a wine. Did you just not want to wait for it to turn into vinegar and you just went straight for the wine?
Wait, what did I say? Did I say?
I have no idea, but it wasn't a word. It was not a word.
Oh my God, I can't even say. Is it reputed or reputed? Reputed,
I think,
right?
It's reputed, but I don't know the sentence you're looking at, so I can't give you context. Okay. And you've given me literally no context clues.
No, I know. Reputed to be the largest of all sea creatures and capable of devouring seven whales. It is variously known as Cuartagvor Achuan, Great Whirlpool of the Ocean. Oh my God. Thanks, you guys, for giving me, like, Summer doesn't like to have any languages. Yeah,
Gaelic is not
my forte.
I'll speak English. That's a language.
I know that, but that's it. Miel vor achun, great beast of the ocean, and wille vesht achun, monster of the ocean. Okay. And we have a link to that as well. So I apologize for potentially butchering the Gaelic. I'm still a novice at Gaelic learning. Back to the chapter. This little girl is getting close to the edge, to the rails, and as they're sitting there talking about this sea monster, and Roger pulls her away, but she sees a large shape in the sea and freaks. Roger assures her it's not a sea monster but a shark.
Oh, that's reassuring.
Thanks, Rog. Oh my goodness. Eileen P. writes, there's a shark half the length of the ship swimming alongside the ship. I can't get the Jaws theme song out of my head. Roger thinks on their reality. The ship is, quote, no more than a fragile shell at the mercy of forces that could crush her in moments and everyone aboard, unquote. Now, Summer, have you ever had such thoughts either, say, aboard a ship? Have you ever been aboard a big ship?
I've been on a cruise ship. And then we were on a sailboat last year. We did a sailboat. Remember we did the sailboat to the snorkeling adventure?
Yes. Yes, that was quite open. And I mean, anything bad can happen anytime, don't get me wrong. But that, I think I naturally, maybe incorrectly, but I naturally would have less fear, at least boarding and riding on it and then getting off or going swimming, whatever. But if you have been a passenger on a cruise, and I've never actually been on a cruise. I've been on a ferry, like legit overnight ferries where I've gotten seasick, but I've never been like on a cruise, an actual tourist cruise. So when you are on a boat, even if it's the one that we went on in Hawaii last year, did you ever feel, not necessarily in danger, but did you ever feel like, oh my gosh, we are this really tiny speck on this huge ocean?
No, and I'll tell you why. We were always in view of land, which gives me the thought in my brain that there's a chance I can make it there if I have to. Whereas when you're in the middle of the great wide ocean and you cannot see land in any direction, that would make me feel small and maybe a little bit more in danger. You know what I mean?
Totally, girl. That's any answer is your answer, is your truth. I would never knock your opinion.
I mean, I would knock yours.
Dude. But look, that's how we roll here. But while I would never knock your opinion, because whatever you're feeling is your feeling. You can't, I may not be able to identify with it, but that doesn't mean that it's not real for you.
Well, yeah.
The reason I pointed that out or asked that or am glad you said something like that is because that's very logical. You know what I mean? If you can see land, okay, if you're not a swimmer and you can see land, it probably doesn't help you feel much better. And even if you're a swimmer, you can still totally like die. Obviously, you can still drown. But if it's if it's a planned shipwreck, if it's a planned sinking, yeah, there is no such thing as there's no such thing as a planned sinking. But if it's something where the boat's been damaged or it comes on, you know, kind of slowly, but they know it's coming and they have enough. They have a dinghy or they have a rowboat or they have at least enough like rafts and life jackets. If you're a swimmer, you know, there's land in sight and there's not stormy conditions and you can actually see, you know, which direction you're going.
And there's not chummed water with sharks already circling.
Well, yeah, I never thought about land being in view or not and how that would make me feel. Absolutely. Because Roger's like land, forget land ho. There's like land no. So there's nothing around.
I think that's
so if
the
you were
title
in Rogers, land no.
Land no.
So land no. Mm-hmm. Summer. That's funny. So another quick question.
Yes.
Have you ever felt like that in an airplane?
First of all, I can rarely see outside of the windows. So it's a very strange, like I have no concept of what's going to happen if anything bad happens. If we're going down in a plane, I'm assuming it's over. There's no coming back from that. That's not the show Lost. Though to be honest, they were all in purgatory, which means they were all dead anyway. But I just consider if we're going down, the odds of us surviving it, regardless of where you land, is irrelevant. So I would consider any plane flight way more treacherous. Speaking of, last weekend I watched The Mountain Between Us. It had Kate Winslet. And
this episode has to be called Kate Winslet. Kate, land no.
Idris Elba, I believe is how he pronounces his name. And they had charted this like very small flight and the pilot has a stroke while they're flying through a storm over like the Colorado mountains and the plane goes down. Now, granted, if they're already in the mountains, they're tall mountains, so they didn't really have that far to fall. So I guess they maybe had a chance of surviving, and they did obviously survive the plane crash. They made a movie of everything that happened after they landed. So it's funny you should bring up planes because that immediately brought all those images from that movie back to my brain. Good movie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I agree. Plane. I'm not afraid to fly, but if stuff goes wrong on a flight, it's a lot less likely that, I mean, really wrong, not like we have to do an emergency landing. If there's some kind of control and there's a way to land, I think they do their best, obviously. But at least on the ocean, if God forbid something happens and you can get a life jacket or something, you can float. I mean, yeah, there's sharks, don't get me wrong. You can float, but at least there's a chance, especially if there's land in sight. Yeah, I think you would have more of a chance there than, falling out of the sky. So after he finishes his water duties of handing out water and filling up their little vessels for the passengers, a woman with a little boy asks Roger if the captain would give them a wee rub with his ring. The little boy had a sore eye.
How low on the totem pole must Roger be that his duty was to pass out water to passengers?
I don't know.
Because on a boat, when it's a very, you know, sailing is a very physical,
vigorous,
yeah, labor-intensive work. And to be like, for whatever reason, they're like, yeah, you're going to pass out water.
I think it's a job, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's a duty that he actually liked. I think he wanted to.
I'm sure he liked it because it's better than climbing riggings, pulling sails, trimming masts, whatever. I'm using all the wrong terminology.
That's fair. But I think it's something like the other seamen. I think the other seamen, like, it's like below that. You know what I mean? I think they gladly give it away.
Of course they would. Like I said, it's a low rung totem position.
Exactly. So he's so yeah. So it's two parts, right? He is the new kid on the block. Okay.
I want you to know that I thought you were having a stroke for a second.
Wait, huh?
That's what it sounded like to me.
Oh my god.
Summer. That's terrible. Good. When you listen back to this for editing, you'll hear what I mean.
So he is literally the new kid on the block, literally. And so it is, seems like it might be a task that would be, you know, kind of given down to the lowest person. But also he doesn't mind it. So it's like two reasons for him to have it. Like he's willing to do it. But yeah, that's interesting. So this whole thing about rubbing a little boy's eye with a ring, mm-hmm. like the little ring on the captain's mm-hmm. hand, finger, whatever. This whole thing, I'm just guessing. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm just guessing that this is before, linguistically, this comes before the time in history when the word ring had another certain meaning. Now, do you know what I'm referring to?
No.
Okay. Let's just say I learned it when I was in Scotland. I know it's not from the early 2000s. It's older than that. This usage is older than that. But that's when I learned about it in Scotland from a Scot. So a ring is obviously something you wear on your finger, right? Or put around something. A ring is also kind of like colloquial for...
Like a butthole? Where are we going with this?
Yes, a butthole. But I'm trying to think of like the type of muscle, the sphincter, a sphincter muscle.
I mean, I've heard of like the ring of fire, like when you're pushing a baby out.
Yeah, that's like your vahani. So let me read this again.
My vagine.
Vahine, yes. Let me read this again. After he finishes his water duties, a woman with a little boy asks him if the captain would give them a wee rub with his ring.
Nasty. You're nasty, Ginger.
His eye.
The eye of his ring.
His eye. I'm not nasty. Oh, God. Anyway, they approach Bonnet, who is also strung out looking. It's so interesting.
Well, with everyone
this
rubbing
exchange.
His ring. I'd be a little strung
gosh,
out, too.
Right? He doesn't. It hasn't happened yet. They're trying to get over. They're just getting over
this
that.
This is just the latest. The latest in requests of ring rubbing.
Bonnet's face hardens when he sees Roger, but then softens when he hears the request. Quote, without comment, he reached down and rubbed the gold ring he wore on his little finger over little Gilbert's closed eyes. A plain, wide band, Roger saw. It almost looked like a wedding ring, though smaller. A woman's ring, maybe. The formidable Bonnet... with a love token? Could be, Roger supposed. Some women might find the captain's air of subdued violence attractive. Unquote.
I mean, I'll tell you where he got that ring.
That's where we're going to go.
You spend a third of your life in your sheets. They make a difference with how you sleep. Start getting better sleep with the best sheets. Brooklinen.com. They have the best, most comfortable sheets with no big markup. Upgrading your nightly routine will help you feel more rested every day.
Founded in April of 2014 by husband and wife team Vicky and Rich Fullup, their philosophy, the most beautiful, comfortable home essentials, no crazy prices. Brooklinen is the fastest growing bedding brand in the world. Over 20,000 five-star reviews. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today.
And what I loved most about these sheets when I purchased them is that they literally, and I know I've said this before, but they literally go with whatever you already have going on in your house, be it white, gray, because I know charcoal is super popular right now. They have sheets that will go with anything you already have in your house. Like they are very versatile and they are patterns and colors that will mix and match and complement any decor.
I do have some charcoal sheets already, but I decided the reason I wanted white everything, white duvet cover, white fitted sheet, and also white pillowcases was because it would go with literally everything I have. Other duvets that I have, other sheet sets. You can totally find something that will go with what you already have.
Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've slept on. Brooklinen has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com.
Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 16-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever.
So as the mother and child walk away, the child seems to have what the mother is calling a milk rash. And this will come up later. Well, actually pretty soon.
I spent some time on Google with that.
Milk rash?
My Google history is now include things like smallpox and milk rash and milk rash versus smallpox.
What is it? Did you look at pictures?
Yeah.
What does a milk rash look like?
It does not look like smallpox to me. But I'm sure that the pictures of smallpox are only showing the severe pictures of smallpox. You know, they always have the – no one's showing like, oh, he had mild smallpox. I don't even know if there's such a thing as mild smallpox. Anyway.
Yeah.
All of the pustules that came along with smallpox were all large,
okay,
and very pronounced. Whereas the milk rash looks like a bunch of like acne, like little tiny pimples, like little tiny whiteheads. Like, I mean, they're red, so they're inflamed, but they just look like a bunch of
dots,
inflamed pimples. Mm. They did not look like the big flat pustules that the smallpox rash looked like. To me.
Eileen P. writes, Bonin, and we're just going to jump right in there. So there we go. Bonnet is using Claire's gold wedding ring to cure Wee Gilbert's sore eyes. It's almost as if Claire left some magical healing power on the ring. Now, obviously, it's not going to heal. It's an enchantment, right? It's folklore. It's a belief. It is not. A ring is not going to cure the baby's sore eyes. We got it. However, because it is being associated with healing and the ring is Claire's and Claire is a healer, that's mighty strong. Yes. That's mighty powerful. Just that association. And I definitely associated a ring with Claire, but I didn't associate supposed healing of the ring with Claire's healing. Did you ever link those two?
No, because I didn't really consider it to be actual healing involved. I just thought it was just all superstition.
Oh, it is.
And, you know, placebo effect.
Well, it is. I'm just saying the fact that Diana includes that at all is very interesting.
I mean, it is, but it isn't. I think she was looking for a reason to showcase the fact that he still has the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael M. writes, the first time I read Drums of Autumn, by the time I got to this part of the book, I had forgotten the name of the antagonist in the early chapters. Even when the mate mentions the river to Cross Creek, I did not put two and two together to remember that the captain of the Gloriana was the same Stephen Bonnet that played pirate to our primary pair on the same river. Roger only has mind for the conversation he'd overheard before asking Bonnet about using his ring. Geez, this just doesn't get any better, does it? Every time I use it, I think of the butthole.
Stop.
There would be stops in New Bern and Edenton before Wilmington. And Bonnet was in no rush. Roger's worried it could be weeks till he'd get to Wilmington. And now he's freaking out. He plans to peace out once they get to their first port.
I really want to see Roger actually peace out.
Like thump its chest with the peace sign?
And then make a peace sign.
Dixon, the man who had been chatting with Bonnet before Roger had interrupted him, was now walking among the passengers, which Roger finds odd because he's not a sociable man. Later that night, Roger's woken up by shouting two nights later. And when he tries to get up to go on deck to see what's going on, Dixon knocks him back, telling him to stay where he is. He hears struggles on deck, a woman yelling, "Murderers!" and then a heavy thump as she was silenced. and now women and children are shrieking. As he goes up to get a look, Dixon again tells him to stay down. Does he want to catch the pox? Roger struggles with Dixon and climbs up to the deck. He finally gets up. He was afraid. He was like, is this pirates? Are we being boarded? What's going on? And he realizes quickly that they aren't being boarded. There are no pirates. There were no other ships.
Silly Roger. This isn't Dragonfly and Amber.
Or Voyager.
Or Voyager, excuse me. This isn't Voyager when every boat ends up being boarded.
Sorry. This isn't every other Diana Gabaldon book with a ship.
This is literally the only ship in the entire series that does not get boarded I would say by pirates.
I don't know about the ship.
Foreigners.
But at least the book, a book. Among the noise of the passengers, quote, a bundle of rags was handed up, passed rapidly from hand to hand, disappeared behind the shifting mass of limbs and clubs. There was a heavy splash to port, and then another, unquote. Roger lets them know that he has had smallpox and that it's safe for him to be up there. And a man is trying to carry a child away from its mother, and the mother crawls up his back, upending both of them. Roger is just able to grab the child before it falls. It was Wee Gilbert, the lad with the sore eyes. He could tell from the boy's face, full of pustules, that it was the pox. And just as he saw this, the boy was taken from him, and there was another splash. There are more scuffles, and Roger is downed and kicked. In all the confusion, he sees Morag Mackenzie's husband, who is PO'd. Quote, the stronger had been clubbed into submission, the weaker forced back, and those sick of the pox, unquote. The keening of the mother who had lost children, the mothers who had lost children, would not stop. Roger couldn't dampen the sounds. He breathed and breathed, quote, as though he must breathe for those who could not, unquote. Whew. Hutchison, his crewmate, told him that it was normal. If they hadn't released the boys, hadn't set, you know, the children, then the pox would have spread. As he's imagining the bodies being dropped overboard, something bumps the hull. Quote, he had heard the seamen say that sharks never sleep, unquote. Okay, let's go back to that boat now. If you were in a boat sleeping, whether you saw land or not during the day, and you were sleeping below deck, and you knew that your head or your body, wherever you were lying down, was near a wall or a side of the ship that was literally on the other side of this was water, and something bumped from the outside.
I wouldn't enjoy that, no.
Oh, I didn't think so. That would freak me out a little bit, or a lot bit. As he is remembering the last few minutes, we remember the words the fair-haired man had said during the scuffle. So the fair-haired man, of course, is referring to the husband of Morag, right? Quote, for the love of God, let her go, unquote. So there's some kind of scuffle. Morag Mackenzie's husband says, let her go. Their child's a boy. So the only female must be Morag. So there must have been some reason that there was a scuffle that her husband was trying to save her from something, right? But that's what we're kind of led into. So Morag was trying to get away to go somewhere or to do something or not to do something. Okay. The next day.
I think she was trying to not have her baby thrown overboard.
Well, that's what we're going to find out. The next day, Roger goes into the hold. He was down around where all the crates and goods were kept, but he just knew someone was down there. He senses movement and after a scuffle, finds it to be Morag Mackenzie. And she's freaking out. She has her husband's dirk in there. He's trying to like calm her down and say, look, I'm not going to hurt you. I just, you know, what's going on? Let me see your son, blah, 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 blah. And in a little bit of scuffle, struggle, whatever, she stabs him a little bit, like in his finger with a knife. She has her husband's knife. And she's saying, please, you can't let them kill him. And he's like, what? And then he hears the sound of a baby. She is down there with her baby. Roger promises he won't hurt her. Morag swears the child isn't sick. But he does have a rash. Now, is this possibly a milk rash? Roger convinces her to trust him. She needs someone who can bring water and food to her, or they'll both die, she and the baby. Roger swears on his own woman's life and the heads of his unborn sons. Then She let him see the baby. And there are also rats down there. Yum. Upon his inspection, he could see the baby was not truly sick. Morag tells him that it will take 4 to 5 days for the rash to heal, but in 2 days, it'll look different. It'll be safer. She can come out in 2 days' time. And if it were the pox, Roger reckoned, it would be dead by then anyway. She says she can stay awake that long. And the reason she's saying stay awake is because when she falls asleep, the rats start to literally eat her. And he says that he'll help her. We find out that she had turned 22 the day before. Happy birthday to me. Eileen P. writes, the pox outbreak demonstrates the horrors of sailing in the 18th century. Disease can spread so quickly in confined quarters. We saw this in Voyager when Claire tried to stop the spread of typhoid. With the pox outbreak, Roger witnesses infected children being pulled from their mother's arms and flung into the sea. While one reasons that it must be done to save lives and that the children would have died soon anyway, it is just so horribly distressing and agonizing. Quote, pox spreads like wildfire. None in the hold would live to make landfall did we not take out the sick. Unquote. Also, Roger demonstrates his musical nature by hearing the sounds of the ship as music. Quote, everything in the hold was vibrating very slightly, thrumming to the shiver of the hull beneath. He could hear it, if he listened closely, the lowest note of the ship's song. So, I don't know about you, what did you find the most terrifying part of that chapter? Can you even, I know it's fiction, but the thing is, I'm sure this happened. Children, adults, whatever. I mean, that's like an easy way to get rid of someone. And technically,
just getting them thrown overboard.
Yeah. Well, the thing that terrified me the most is that because of how dangerous
sea travel was, and because of, like you said, how virulent viruses are. That's terrible. How bad it is that's how easily sickness transfers from person to person on an enclosed space where you literally can't get away from it. There's no way to quarantine it on a boat like that. You know, they're rightfully scared. I mean, look at the previous books. They had entire boats full of cargo that were lit on fire because there was a whispering of the pox, not even proof of it, you know? And so every last one of those sailors, and a lot of sailors at the time had, you know, they got paid from the profits of the sale of the things on the ship. So not only is it fear of catching whatever and dying, but it's also your livelihood. You know, it's arriving at port and not being able to collect or sell your items. But also the fear of a mother who has a child who has rashes. And babies get the weirdest skin things. It's just because they've spent, you know, 9 months in a completely liquid environment and they come out and their skin's like, what the fuck? What is this? What's going on? I mean, every baby goes through that phase where they just have like baby acne. And we don't call it milk rash anymore, but just baby acne where they just have random like red spots or blotches or, you know, your babies aren't always the cutest. Sometimes they have bad skin days. And to live in a time period when there is a sickness that looks similar to the sickness that's killing everybody and is contagious and will kill people that it comes in contact with, and fear that somebody who's not a doctor is going to just see a rash and assume the worst and potentially kill your baby. I mean, especially if, you know, like Morag, she's from a family of, I don't know how many babies. She said like what, like 9 or 10 babies that her mom had. So she's like, I'm familiar. This is just milk rash. I've seen this hundreds of times before, however many times. But I don't know. I think that would have been the scarier thing.
I mean, what do you do with, oh my God, I can't even.
And she's just leaving the baby down in the hold to go find food. I mean.
I don't think she was. She did. I think what happened was the boys, the sick people, right? Sick children, whatever, were thrown over. In the end, or I think maybe Roger was going to bed or something happened, but in a struggle between, I think they were trying to take Morag's son, their son, away. And her husband was fighting, say, and that's when he said, leave her alone, let go of her. He's not sick or whatever he said. And Roger heard this and also saw the struggle. And there's some mention at the end of the chapter, I'd have to bring it up, about him, like, as he went off to sleep or in his dream, he saw someone. So Roger goes down under or to wherever his cot, his hammock, and he's trying to sleep and he's not able to. He can't shut out the sounds, the memories, everything. And he's praying and he rolled again, squirming, trying to escape. And in the echo of the futile prayer found memory, the misplaced hearing of those few frantic words panted in his ear during those moments of unthinking frenzy. So after the frenzy is when he goes down to try and sleep. During the frenzy, when this fight breaks out, that's when Morag and her husband and the child, you know, kind of have a kerfuffle with one, I'm guessing one of the maids or one of the seamen, who says, probably said that the child was ill. And after that, further, "For the love of God, man," the fair-haired man had said, "for the love of God, let her go." So that was him trying to get Morag and the baby away from whoever was, you know, going after her. Roger straightened and lay stiff, bathed in cold sweat. Two figures in the shadow and the open hatchway to the store's hold some 20 feet away. So he's like having a flashback of these words that were said and then two figures. So obviously the baby's not a figure. It would have been the man and the Morag and her husband. And her husband probably, of course, helped her get down there. And I think her husband, I would guess that her husband likely, of course, knew where she was, but her husband was probably going to either to try to bring them food, or her plan was to leave him and bring him food. So I don't think they had that chance because she was down there. Could you imagine?
No.
I mean, that's, oh God.
But the whole thing is just unimaginable. It's disturbing. I mean, you think about it. There's not a single doctor on that boat. And most people who've seen the smallpox, who've been around somebody who has the rash, is going to catch it and die too. So nobody lives long enough to tell people what it really looks like. All they hear is, well, it was a rash. You know what I mean? So all they see is rash. That can't be. That's got to be sickness. They're going to kill us all, you know? Mm-hmm. But also,
better safe than sorry. And we don't care if we're wrong.
Well, it's not only that, but even if whispers are heard about a rash on board, like happened in Voyager, or no, that one was Dragonfly and Amber, when they were rubbing themselves in nettle and, you know, taking whatever to pee blood.
Oh, yeah.
So even just giving the appearance of the illness.
Oh, you're right. He's lucky he wasn't thrown
exactly.
overboard.
Exactly.
Gracious. This is like 20 years later.
Yeah.
Or so-ish. Uh-huh. 23, 25, 26. Yep. Gracious. Oh, wow. I wonder if that's an interesting point. How was Claire so sure that he wouldn't be thrown overboard?
Hmm. Because
she wasn't with them.
One, no, she wasn't with them, but they went together. There was the two of them,
Myrta
and Jamie. So they went together. And also I don't think that the travel was nearly as far as to going to the New World. Weren't they just going from like England to France?
Jamie and Claire went from Scotland to France. At the Abbey de Saint-Anne.
Yeah. But I think the boat was going from like.
Okay. Yeah. And then
France
when they planned
Spain,
it was Portugal.
I'm just going to keep saying places.
Portugal. It was a boat to Portugal and then to make a purchase and then to take the boat back.
Right. So it's not nearly the sea voyage that Roger's on currently. In fact, most of the places where they are sailing are probably within at least. They should be able to see land from the boat because they're not going into giant open waters, right? So I don't know. I'm sure she was confident that between the two of them, they could get to safety. And they were also not supposed to show symptoms until they were just outside of harbor.
Until it was too close.
Yeah. So that was another thing they did. It was like, well, don't take the stuff until you're close enough to land.
Because actually the whole point, if I'm not mistaken, was to, yes, affect the smallpox, but the whole point was to not be thrown overboard. Because if he got thrown overboard, not only would she obviously lose her Jamie, that would make the whole trip a bust because they were supposed to go, he was supposed to be riding back on the ship with the wine, right? And have smallpox just outside of port. And rather than having... Well, the plan was to be able to buy that port cheap and not let it. Well, no, if it had to be destroyed, it could be destroyed. But it was to the detriment
of to do something that would be detrimental to the
Comte.
Yeah.
Yes. If it meant him losing it, like by fire or sinking,
or buying it out, from
so be
under
it.
Him,
if it, you know, it was exactly
the whole
exactly.
point was to do something that would negatively affect him.
Yeah. And so they then had to time it pretty well to make sure that his symptoms showed up just at the right time. So yeah, there definitely was a lot less danger for Jamie because it was a plan and he could pretty much control when this was happening into a very narrow window. And his symptoms were annoying, but they didn't make him sick. Like he was itchy and he peed red, you know what I mean? But he had to fake sick, basically. So if someone did try and remove him, unless they had like 20 men, you know, he's pretty strong.
No, that's not what happened. Remember, it was supposed to be Murta. But because Jamie was already full of seasickness, they went ahead and dosed him instead.
That's true.
Because he didn't have to pretend to be sick.
Jamie's never a good
putting him on a boat is always a bad idea.
Exactly.
But no, it's better now that he has all of his little acupuncture pins. That was chapter 38. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 39 entitled A Gambling Man. This makes me think of two things. It makes me think of the song that's actually Rambling Man. Lord, I was born a rambling man. And then it also makes me think of Kenny Rogers, the gambler.
Oh, that's a good
song. Right? It's a great song. I played that, I don't know, a few months ago, and I was like, I love this song.
Is it? Down in the West,
nope.
Texas,
County. That is not it. That's El Paso. The gambler is, you better know when to hold him.
Know when to walk away.
Know when to run. Anyway.
You better count your money.
While you're sitting,
at the table.
Oh, the barn is going to kill you. If the coin is wrong. What?
I was trying to actually finish the song. Just that when the deal is done, but what comes before
There'll
that?
Be time enough counting for counting out. When the dealing's done.
Time enough for counting when the deal is done. Got it.
Yeah.
As always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group. If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us on Patreon. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. And one of the best ways that you can help spread the word is to, as you're listening, either on your phone or in your car via Bluetooth audio, however you listen to it, either take a screenshot or take a picture of the thing you're listening on so we can see that it's the episode number or see our logo, whatever, the Outlander podcast. And share it on social media, on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and say, hey, look what I'm listening to. And be sure to tag us and we will share it. And you can tag us at Outlander Pod in all the places. So thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.